we present Norman Shelley as Gideon Fell and Barbara Cooper as Madame Dumont, with Lockwood West and David March in The Hollow Man, a play of mystery and magic by John Keir Cross from the early novel by John Dixon Carr. The Hollow Man.
Hello there. I suppose this is an old tale now. 1935 it was. But I like to look back on it all as something very strange that I was once tied up with, as a kind of interested observer. And I suppose it was one of the great Gideon Fell's most famous and fantastic cases. By the way, my name's Rampole, Ted Rampole. I was a friend of Dr. Fell's. I used to visit him in those Adelphi Terrace chambers of his when I was in London from the States. Do you remember the doc? That big bulk of his and the black cloak and the old shovel hat. He was a bit like that English writer of yours, G.K. Chesterton.
I tell you, son, that the whole thing's impossible. Here's a fella goes into a room before two pairs of eyes and he commits a murder. And then he vanishes. And here's a fella walking along a street and he drops dead and three blamed witnesses to see him doing it. And not a sign of a soul this time either. Not a blazing footprint in the snow all around him. Wow, I tell you, it's magic, son. But there wasn't any magic yet that couldn't be explained somehow, and I'm going to explain it. By Bacchus, I am. Who ever heard of a hollow man, hey? The Hollow Man.
Yes, the Hollow Man. That was what we came to call that invisible murderer in that old winter of long ago. And the first of us to die from him was a queer kind of guy called Professor Grimaud. Now, you'll have to forgive me if I make quite a spiel at the start here, because to begin with, this is a sort of prologue to the story, 3 nights before the professor's actual death itself, and it needs a bit of explaining. He was a wealthy old bird, this Grimaud, pretty big and strong for all his age. He'd lived in England for about 30 years, and his academic subject was low magic, old legends and such. Vampires and werewolves, works. About 5 or 6 nights a week, he and some of his cronies would meet in one of your old London pubs, the Warwick, just around the corner from Russell Square. The professor used to hold forth there on those macabre subjects of his, and his cronies were a pretty mixed bunch. Young Mangan, the newspaper man, who was a friend of my own, and Burnaby, the artist, and young Stuart Mills, the professor's secretary, with one or two other general bohemians of the day. So, there they were this particular winter's night when the stranger came in. He was someone none of them had ever seen before. Though Boyd Mangan told me there was something kind of familiar about him, too. It was Mangan himself who was holding forth at the time, egging the professor on a bit.
But, Professor Grimaud, what puzzles me, frankly, is your own attitude to the whole business of magic.
So there, Mangan. In what way, pray?
Well, now, I dabbled a bit in ghost stories. I'd even tried to write one or two myself. But it's only fiction I started. Only ghost stories that never happened. But you are an authority on attested happenings. Things that we're forced to call facts. And yet you don't believe a word, sir.
Don't I, my young friend? It depends surely on what you mean by belief.
Very well. Now, take the vampire legend that we were talking about last night. Do you believe in that?
But of course, who doesn't? It's one of the most widespread low magic legends in the world.
Come now, Professor. Mangan is surely getting you to exaggerate. You can hardly believe that dead men can leave their coffins and float in the air, surely.
My dear Mills, I said that it was a question of what one means by believe. In a sense, I am the man who knows too much. What I am interested in is the causes behind these superstitions. Now, the vampire legend is a belief that prevails mainly in Slavonic lands. Agreed? It got its firm grip on Europe when it swept in a blast out of Hungary between 1730 and 1735. But why?
Very well, then. Why, sir?
Because, Mangan, those were the plague years. Think of all the poor devils who were buried alive, although they were believed to be dead. Think how they struggled. Terribly. And then, when sounds of the struggle had been heard, perhaps, and an occasional body had been exhumed from some churchyard, what was found? The poor corpses in twisted positions, with blood on their hands and faces. Was it any wonder that in those terrible times there were visions of the living dead who left their graves?
You see, gentlemen, that's what I mean by the causes behind the superstitions. That is what I am interested in.
I also, Professor Grimaud. I also am interested in such things.
What? Who the deuce are you, sir? What do you mean coming in on a private party like this?
You must forgive me, gentlemen. Shall we say that I overheard? And I should like to ask the famous Professor Grimaud a question.
Now, look here, whoever you are.
Right, my friend. Well, sir?
I gather, Professor Grimaud, that you do not believe that a man can get up out of his coffin, that he can move anywhere invisibly, that four walls are nothing to him, and that he is as dangerous as anything out of hell.
I do not. Do you?
Oh, yes. For I have done it.
Oh, now listen.
But, Father, Mr. Grimaud, I have a brother, too, who can do still more than I can, and he is even more dangerous to you. To you, personally. I do not want your lifeblood, but he calls out
for it. Oh, confound it, Professor. This fellow's stark mad. Here, give me a hand to get him out first.
No, Mangan. Let him alone. Let him talk about his brother and his coffin.
Three coffins.
All right, three coffins, as many as you like, in heaven's name. Now, perhaps you will tell us who you are.
Permit me to present my card, Professor Grimaud. And before I go, I have one last question for you. Someone is going to call on you one evening very soon. Would you rather I did? Or shall I send my brother?
Very well, then. Send your brother and be damned.
Oh, no. It is you who will be damned.
Well, the prologue. I got an account of that queer business in the pub from young Mangan, whom I happen to know, as I've said. And it was the kind of thing I knew would interest Dr. Fell. So it seemed natural to tell him about it a few wintry evenings later, when he and I were having a glass of his celebrated punch. His old friend, Superintendent Hadley of the CID, was with us, too.
Good life, Rampole. The thing's ridiculous. The fellow was some crank, some loony.
Now, was he, Hadley, eh? And even if he was, it might still make him dangerous, maybe even more dangerous.
Rats, Fell. It's Bloomsbury all over. A bunch of so-called bohemians talking witchcraft in an old pub led by somebody with a scary old womanish mind.
Wait now, that's the point. He isn't. I know Professor Charles Grimaud quite well, as it happens. And I tell you, Hadley, that you don't realize just how queer all this is unless you do. What did this sudden visitor look like, young Ted?
Well, that's the queer thing. Boyd Mangan said they'd hardly much idea, except that in some odd way there was this something familiar about him. It was pretty dark in that corner of the pub, and the fellow had his cap pulled right down and his coat collar up. Grimaud was the only one to see his face when he leaned forward to give him his card.
And what did it say on this card? Mr. Nobody or Count Dracula, maybe?
Oh, no, there was a name all right. They all saw that. It said Pierre Fley, illusionist. F-L-E-Y. It's a queer name. And the address was 2B Cagliostro Street. And then he'd scribbled, or care the Academy Theater.
Confounded conjurer. Theatrical rubbish, the whole thing might have guessed.
Well, anyway, Superintendent, it seems the young Mangan was pretty impressed for some reason. He's been making inquiries these past few days. Oh, by the way, Boyd Mangan's fallen rather hard for old Grimaud's daughter, Rosette, so I suppose he's kind of interested.
Well, go on, son. What did he find?
Well, he went on the prowl around this Academy Theater place, broken down old music hall in the East End. Seems that this Pierre Fley guy is known among the stage staff as Loony Fley. One up to you, Mr. Hadley. Well, they don't know much about him at all. He hardly speaks to a soul, ducks out after every show.
What's his line, Ted?
Sort of super conjuring, with a specialty in vanishing tricks. And according to young Mangan again, he works without an assistant, and all his props together can go into a box about the... Well... About the size of a coffin.
Oh, damn it, the fellow's got coffins on the brain.
Apparently he has, Mr. Hadley. That's still another point. He's always talking about them. And once, some Irish acrobat who works in the theater, too, asked him why. Got a jump he didn't expect, I can tell you.
How, son? Yeah, have another ladle of punch, Hadley. You need it from the look of you.
Oh, thank you. Well, apparently Flay turned round with a queer kind of grin. And he said, three of us were once buried alive. Only one escaped. And when the Irishman said, and how did you escape?
Do you know what Flay said?
Well?
He said, but I didn't. I was one of the other two.
By Bacchus, this is the stuff, son. This is the real stuff.
Now, look here, Phil. If you're starting off on any of your hocusing...
Now, hang on, Hadley. Now, hang on, my lad. Ted, what happened in the pub when this super conjurer made his exit, hey? How did it end?
Well, that's another funny thing. It seems they all try to make a joke of it, and old Grimo was as merry as the rest of them, but Mangan swears that secretly he was actually scared green.
And what then, son?
Well, the old boy phoned Boyd Mangan yesterday and said, I want you to be at the house on Saturday evening. Somebody threatens to pay me a visit.
That's tonight.
Exactly. Anything else? Anything else, Ed?
Well, Mangan advised the professor to warn the police if he thought there was any real threat, but Grimo wouldn't hear of it. He said... You'll hardly believe it, Dr. Fowler.
Son, I believe anything I do. What did Charlie Grimo say?
He said that he had a better way of defending himself from the police. He was going to buy a painting.
Oh, what?
A painting to hang on the wall of his study. And I'm not joking, Superintendent. He did buy it. Kind of landscape. Oh, weird business, showing some trees and gravestones. A huge affair. It took two workmen to carry it up the stairs. It was painted by Burnaby, the artist guy who was a member of Grimo's club in the Warwick.
Hadley, my boy, if I were you, I'd start to warm up my car.
Eh?
Yeah. Do you know Charlie Grimo's address, son? Russell Square somewhere, huh?
Yeah, one of those big houses on the west side.
Right. Come on, Hadley.
But confound it, Phil. It's a devil of a night out there. It's been snowing steadily all evening.
Yeah, it stopped a few minutes ago. But you're right. Maybe it is a devil of a night. A real devil. I tell you, my lad, that when an alleged lunatic threatens a sane man, then you may or you may not be disturbed. But when the sane man begins to act like the lunatic himself, then I know I'm jolly well disturbed. We're going to have a look at that place, even if we only cruise past. Come on!
But the hollow man had been... And he'd gone again before we ever reached that old house in the square. And all we found of Professor Grimo was something all red that was trying to drag itself on its hands and knees across the black carpet of his study. And then choked and rolled over on its side and lay still.
Look out! Peter, look out, damn you!
That was when we first reached the house itself. We were just cruising past, as Fell had suggested, and suddenly a blind was torn aside on one of the ground floor windows, and the window flew open, and somebody leapt out right over the spiked area rails, slipped over the pavement in the snow, and as near as damn it was under the car wheels before Hadley braked and jumped out to collar him.
What the deuce did you mean by that, you young idiot? You might have killed us all.
Let go of me! Let me go, confound you!
Wait a minute, Mr. Hadley. It's young Mangan.
Oh, Ted Rempel. How did you get here? Quick, Ted, in heaven's name, get somebody. Come along yourself. He's still up there.
Who is? What are you talking about, Mangan?
We heard a shot. Upstairs, the professor's study. Just this minute. He'd locked us in, you see.
Now, steady on, son. Steady now. Who locked you in?
He did. The visitor. And he's still up there. He must be. In heaven's name, come on.
Right, son. We're with you. You better switch off your engine, Hadley. I have a feeling we're going to be here for some time.
When we did find Grimo in that upstairs room of his, alone. And just before he did roll over, he tried to say something. All three of us, Dr. Fell and Hadley and I, all of us heard him. And yet, later on, we all had different versions of what we heard. And that was one of the biggest mysteries of the lot. Now, just here, at this part of it all, you'll have to forgive me if I say another sizable little piece, but it's kind of important to put you in the picture. And I mean the picture. This study of the professor's was on the right-hand side at the top of the central stairway in the house. There was a kind of hallway facing the door of it, and at the opposite side of that, there was another room, a workroom for Grimo's secretary. When we got out to the study, there were two people facing the locked door of it. I'll come back to them in a minute. They're important. Now, I said the study door was locked, and so it was on the inside. We didn't get in to find the dying man until I'd run downstairs again for a pair of pliers from Hadley's toolbox in the car, and he manipulated the key on the inner side through the keyhole in some kind of professional way of his own. Right then, that's the first general outline. We didn't get the full story until the superintendent had arranged for an ambulance to get the unconscious Grimaud to a nearby nursing home and then phoned for some of his men. After that, we really got down to it in that fatal little room itself. And, Lord, it was a mess. It was impossible, the whole thing, from start to finish. The only one who seemed to enjoy himself was old Doc Fell. It was Gideon Fell's big day, I reckon. Or his big night, rather. Before we got through with it all and learned next day of the second murder. And that was even more impossible. But in the meantime, in the study.
Right, gents, so here we are. And my hunch was right, Hadley.
All right, all right. I only wish you'd had it 5 minutes earlier, that's all.
I ain't denying it. Now, look here, young Ted, me son. You're a kind of outside observer. How would you describe this room that we're in?
Oh, for heaven's sake, Phil, we can see for ourselves, can't we?
Wait, wait, me boy. In a case like this, every blame thing is important. What we think we see as well as what we do see. And even what we don't see, too. Right, son, let's have it. The room.
Well, now, about 15 feet square, maybe.
Uh-huh.
Thick black carpet running right out to panel hallway. Panel walls with bookshelves. One door that we broke in by. One window over there, partly open, and with heavy brown drapes. Big desk, not much on it.
Don't forget the decorations, too, son. They may be important as well.
All right. Some kind of carved ornament on the desk. Sort of buffalo, I'd say. Yellow jade. With a little inlaid looking glass. The only glass in the room, by the way. Big sofa near the fireplace with blood on it. Though we found Grimaud on the floor. That's the only place where there seems to have been any kind of struggle, by the way, in front of the fireplace.
Right, son, you're doing fine. And the fireplace itself?
Pretty massive. Heavy stone. With some kind of coat of arms above it.
What?
Don't know. Kind of eagle. And a silver moon. Does it matter?
I tell you, everything does. More about the fireplace.
Oh, somebody's been burning a decent lot of papers in it. The fire smothered out.
Fine, fine. And now the famous painting that Grimaud bought to defend himself. Wheel it out, Hadley, so as we can have a better look.
Confound it, Phil. What do you think you're driving
Never
at?
You mind. Just prop it up, my lad. See how space has been cleared to hang it, Ted?
Yeah.
And nobody's got around to doing it yet. Well, what do you make of it, son?
Pretty big to begin with. About 7 feet by 4. A pretty solid frame.
And the subject itself?
Hardly very pleasant, I'd say. Mm. Kind of bleak and eerie. Kind of country that you'd... Well, you'd hardly imagine that it even existed somehow.
Ha! Confound you, Phil. What do you mean, ha?
Just what I say, my boy. Ha! And those three gravestones in the foreground, kid. What do you say about them?
Well, you kind of get the impression that they're... Well, kind of toppling. And... If you get it in a certain light...
Well, then, well...
You could almost swear that the graves are... Well, beginning to heave and crack across almost. Or at least one is.
Good boy. Hey, you can put it back against the wall, Hadley.
Oh, thank you, I'm sure.
So much for what we can see, then. Now for what we can't see. And to begin with, where's the gun that Grimaud was shot with?
I was beginning to wonder when you'd get round to that. Ordinary routine police work is a bit beneath you, I suppose.
Judging by the wound in Grimaud's chest, what we're looking for, my sons, is a high-caliber revolver with something like a .38 bullet. We'll know definitely when they dig it out round in the nursing home. Now, a gun like that's a fair size, so where is it, hey?
Up the chimney?
I've already had a look up that chimney. The flues are pretty widened, I'll admit that, but it's so shallow you can hardly get your flat hand in, let alone a fat revolver.
Oh.
By the way, that rules out the chimney as a way of escape for the murderer, too, if you were thinking about it.
Secret panel, man.
Oh, come off it, son. This is a real murder story we're in.
Is it, Phil? Is it, though? All that talk jabbering away while I was getting the ambulance. Folks saying that they'd seen a man actually walking in here, an old Grimaud talking to him. So where the deuce is he, then? Where's any sign of him?
All over the place.
Stop. Focus. I'm beginning to think it was suicide after all.
Now, you just come off it too, me boy. You know better well it wasn't suicide. There were no powder marks around the wound. Judging from the look of it again, I'd say the shot was fired from a good 10 feet. And another thing, what about Grimaud's last words when we found him, eh? Well, maybe not agreed on all of them, but the one thing I'll swear to myself is that he did say not suicide.
All right, have it your own way. I suppose I did hear that too.
Yes, so did I. So the rest of what he said was pretty queer, I must say.
Now, hold on, son. I'm just coming around to what Grimaud said.
No, I'm scuppered if you are, Phil. I've had enough of this. I'm going back to good old sane police routine, I am. My men will be here any minute, and I can't see Sergeant Betts falling for any vanishing murderer buffoonery. Meantime, I've got the constable in from the beat, seeing that nobody leaves the house. I'm going to question everybody in the confounded place. And I'm going to begin with Grimaud's secretary. He's been waiting outside there all this time.
Wheel him in, my lad. Sit down, Ted. Make yourself at home, son. You'll like this.
Okay.
Will you come in, sir?
Thank you. I've been waiting.
I'm sorry to have kept you. You're Professor Grimaud's secretary, I believe.
I am.
And your name?
Mills. Stuart Mills.
Now, Mr. Mills, how many people live in this house?
Besides Dr. Grimaud and myself, four. Rosette Grimaud, his daughter, Madame Ernestine Dumont, the professor's housekeeper, an elderly friend of Dr. Grimaud's called Raymond, and Annie, the general maid.
Thank you. Now, about what happened here tonight. Where exactly were you yourself at the time of the accident?
I was in my workroom across the hallway out there, sitting at my desk.
For any special reason?
Yes, the professor himself had asked me to do so.
Indeed. May I ask why?
He told me earlier this evening that he was expecting a visitor. At about 9:30, he said. He asked me to sit in my workroom with the door open so that I could watch this door in case...
Well, in case?
He was not specific. I gathered that he felt there might be trouble from this visitor and that he might need help, perhaps.
You know about the threat to Professor Grimaud at the Warwick Tavern on Wednesday night?
I was there myself. I often attended the professor's meetings with his friend.
Did you think that Pierre Flay, the illusionist, might be this expected visitor tonight?
Perhaps.
Very well. Continue. What happened?
After dinner, the professor came up here to work. For my own part, at about 9:25, I took up my position in the room opposite, as instructed. As I was coming up the stairs, I met Madame Dumont, the housekeeper. Let her so. She had just come out of this door with the professor's finished coffee tray. She went downstairs, and I entered my workroom.
Leaving your door open?
Of course, I have been told to.
And what did you see?
At about 9:45, I heard the front doorbell ring. A few minutes later, Madame Dumont remounted the stairs. She was holding one of those trays on which it is customary to carry visiting cards. She was about to knock on the professor's door when I suddenly saw that there was a very tall man in a long black overcoat walking up the staircase behind her. As she turned to the door, Madame Dumont saw him too. She spoke rather agitatedly. I cannot tell you the exact words, but the purport was to ask why the visitor had not waited downstairs, as she had apparently asked him. The tall man made no reply. He walked to the door and took off his cap, which he placed in his overcoat pocket. I think that he laughed. Madame Dumont seemed rather frightened. She pushed open the study door for him and then shrank back against the side wall. Professor Grimaud appeared on the threshold from within in some evident annoyance. I heard his exact words. They were, "What the devil is all this row about?" And then he stood stock still, looking up at the tall man facing him. And his exact words again were, "In heaven's name, who are you?"
Thank you, Mr. Mills. You're an excellent witness. Mm. Now, did you get a really good look at this tall man? Now, think carefully. It's vitally important.
I think so. A fairly good look, just as he mounted the last step and crossed the hallway to the professor's door.
Did you see his face?
No.
Why not? From the angle of your workroom, I should have thought it was inevitable.
I did not see his face, sir, because he was wearing over it a child's false face.
What?
A species of mask in papier-mâché. I have an impression that it was rather long and of a pinkish color, and it had a wide-open mouth.
By Bacchus! By Bacchus! And he didn't take it off, son?
So far as my observation went, sir, he did not. I think I'm safe in asserting
that... You are, Mr. Mills, quite safe. It was a false face. And unfortunately, he did not remove it.
What the deuce? Hang on now, Hadley, my boy. Madame Dumont, I believe.
That is correct, sir. I am Ernestine Dumont. And I have come up to help you find the man who shot Charles Grimaud.
Well, confound it, ma'am. You were in custody downstairs.
Charles Grimaud is lying insensible in a friendless nursing home. It is my wish to go to him. Your constable would not permit me. He said that you would wish to question me first. And so I have come to be questioned.
He should never have let you leave the room.
I quite simply walked past him, sir. I am a very determined woman.
I can well believe it, ma'am. And I suppose there ain't any reason why you shouldn't question her right now. Eh, Hadley?
Well, I suppose not. Madame Dumont, I gather that you heard some of what Mr. Mills was saying.
Almost all from the hallway there. And indeed, Mr. Mills is right. That is how it happened.
You let this fellow with a false face in downstairs?
I did not know of his false face down there in the entrance hall. It is very dark. I saw only his outline after I had opened the door to him.
What exactly did happen down there, ma'am?
This man handed me a visiting card and said that Charles was expecting him. I asked him to wait in the hall while I came up to inquire.
Did you look at the card?
I did, sir, as I mounted. It was blank.
Blank?
On both sides.
Good life, what next? And yet you still came on?
Charles Grimaud was a man of some eccentricity, sir. This visitor had said he was expected. I thought that Charles would know what the card meant.
And then you realized that the fellow hadn't waited in the hall at all. Hey, he'd come up the stairs after you.
It is, as Mr. Mills has said, it was then that I saw the mask and was frightened.
But you still opened the study door for him.
Precisely. Because I was frightened. Because I knew that Charles Grimaud was a very brave and strong man and that he could deal with this intruder better than I.
And after Professor Grimaud asked Falseface who he was, what then? You, Mills.
I got the impression that the professor jumped forward as if to intercept the man. But he was too quick. I mean, the man was. Mm. He pushed forward inside and the door slammed behind him. And I heard the key turning in the lock.
I also.
And you mean to say that neither of you did anything? You just stood there?
You did not know our employer, sir. Madame Dumont stayed listening at the door for a moment. Then she shook the handle, still rather agitated, you'll understand. And the professor called out from inside, "Go away, you fool. I can handle this."
Did he seem afraid or anything of the sort?
On the contrary. I should have said that in a sense he sounded, well, relieved.
Ha! Now, Phil, leave this to me. And you both obeyed him?
I said you do not know our employer, sir. We were accustomed to obey him.
For my part, I made to go downstairs again, but I was much upset and stayed waiting a little way down the first flight, lest I should be needed after all.
And you could still see the study door from there?
Yes.
And no one came out of it again?
No one.
You too, Mills?
I swear it.
And then the sound of the shot?
After about 10 minutes, maybe longer. I rushed across, but the door was still locked. And then you suddenly came on the scene within seconds.
And you, Madame Dumont?
When the shot came, I fear that I felt faint for a moment, sir. I knew that something dreadful had occurred. I was just recovered when you passed me at the stair top.
Yes, I remember. Only I didn't know who you were, of course. Confound it, Fell. The whole thing's idiocy. Yeah. Two witnesses outside to confirm each other and two men inside, and yet when we got in, there was only one man. I'm back where I began, and the only blazing answer is the window.
Excuse me, Superintendent. I've already thought of that, naturally. I looked out and along from one of the corridor windows in the same wall a moment ago. If you look at that window now, you will see what I mean.
Snow. Blasted snow all over the sill. And not a mark on it.
And 50 unbroken feet to the ground, sir. And not a mark on the snow down there either.
The roof, then. That's it. He swung down from the roof somehow and then up again.
And still left no trace on the sill, eh?
And besides, sir, pardon me again, there are no marks on the roof snow either.
How the deuce do you know?
Again, because I looked a few moments ago while I was waiting for your questioning. A small stairway to a skylight rises up from my workroom. I raised the skylight and looked out.
You didn't spoil any possible traces?
There were none to spoil, sir. Even if I had cared to venture on so slippery a sloping surface. The snow on the roof is quite unbroken also.
Then he flew. Confounded, he flew through the air, Phil.
The daring young man on the flying trapeze.
Like the terrible legends of my childhood of evil spirits.
Aye, so it is, ma'am, so it is. And I'll tell you another thing, Hadley, just to be going on with. Snow again.
What now, in glory's name?
It was when we came in ourselves down there into the house after young Mangan. Maybe you didn't notice in all the excitement, but I did. There was snow on the pavement and snow up the front steps, but there wasn't a single footmark on it. Not till we made ours. So how the deuce did Falseface walk along the street and up to the door to ring the bell in the first place, eh? Answer me that one too, son.
Okay, So there you have it, the main outline. Of course, there were all kinds of other bits and pieces, too, by the time we questioned the others in the house. Young Boyd Mangan, for instance. And old Grimaud's pretty daughter, Rosette. They'd been in the downstairs room at the front, you remember. And it seems that False Face simply locked him in as he passed through the hall. That was why Mangan jumped out of the window for help in that spectacular way when he heard the shot. Then there was the queer old fellow Drayman, a Scotsman who lived with Grimaud. It seems the professor had taken him in out of charity or something. Nobody knew quite why, though there was a rumor that Drayman had saved the professor's life once. A sort of invalid, half blind and a bit eccentric. It seems he'd been asleep in his room through the whole thing, and he wasn't much help at all. Needless to say, when Hadley's men arrived and searched the house, there weren't any secret passages or panels. I think Doc Fell would have thrown a fit if there had been. And there was still no gun. Just plainly and simply no traces of the Hollow Man at all. So, how was it done? And what lay behind it all? For instance, later on a bit, when Hadley had let Madame Dumont and Rosette go up to the nursing home where Grimaud was still unconscious.
Now, looky here, my lads. There's more in all this than meets the eye.
In mercy's name, Phil, there are times when I could cheerfully throttle you. By glory, I've a mind to get Pierre Flay to do it for me, too, and leave no trace before we hang him.
Now, wait, just wait now, Hadley. Let's take it in order, hey? By the way, talking of poor Flay, have you sent out for him?
Got one of my best men on it. He's down at the theater now, with any luck. And then he's to go round to his lodgings in this,
Cagliostro Street,
wherever it is.
Just round the corner, son. One of those hidden little alleyways you keep finding in London. Behind Guildford Street. Anyway, you've done the right thing, so now let's sit down and have a chat.
Well, what about, in heaven's name? We've covered everything.
Well, not quite, my boy. There are two things. This Madame Dumont now, for instance.
What about her?
Did it maybe strike you now that she was more than just a housekeeper to old Charlie Grimaud? Or at least had one spin?
Well, of course it did. It stuck out a mile. The whole way she talked about him.
Matter of fact, I even got the impression that maybe Rosette was a daughter by him, Doctor.
Right, son, I'd say so, too. And I think the girl maybe guesses it even. Now then, what nationality would you say that Dumont was?
French, surely, same as Grimaud himself.
Oh, I wonder, Hadley, did you hear those W's of hers as V's occasionally? And besides, there was something she said about the old legends of her childhood and evil spirits that could float through the air, eh?
Oh, I'm sick to death of blasted graves and vampires in this case. Well, what's your own bet about this Dumont woman?
Hungarian, son, Magyar, where the vampire legend started. And where maybe the graves do open.
Rats.
Anyway, keep it in mind, my lad. It's maybe more important than you think. Next, then, let's go right back to something we've hardly talked about at all yet, though maybe it's the very kernel.
What?
When we came in here, that bloody rag that had been Charlie Grimaud managed to gasp out a few broken words before he choked and fell over. What were they, hey?
If you mean the way the three of us seem to hear something different...
That's just what I do mean, my boy.
Right. I'm an old policeman, Phil, and I know the kind of tricks that memory can play on a witness. As soon as I could, I wrote down what Grimaud said, and I've got it here.
Well, let's have it.
I won't pretend it makes sense. It's the craziest dying speech I ever heard. But to begin with, I'm dead certain that he spoke the word salt, and then immediately afterwards, wine.
Right. Salt and wine. Ted, how do you think he started?
Well, I reckon my list doesn't make much sense either. I could have sworn he said hover, and then bath.
Hover? You mean as in flying?
Sure. And then there was something about a tower, or towers, and the number 7.
Ha! I'm even with you there myself, son. I heard that one, too, and it's my whole key.
Oh, confound it, it's rubbish. Whoever talked about bath salts and forgetting bits of rope when they were dying?
Now, wait a bit. Steady, Hadley. How do you mean bits of rope?
Because that's the next phrase on my list. He distinctly said... forgot about rope.
I'm in on that, too. Maybe meaning that his murderer didn't think he'd hang.
He will, if there is a murderer at all.
Before we're much older, I'm going to introduce him to you, my boy. Anything else in Charlie's final speech?
The only bit with any sense to it. He said, not suicide. And then he finished up, don't blame poor... And then he keeled over before he could give the name.
Yeah, I agree. That's my version as well.
And mine. So there we are, gents. The only thing we stick on is this bath and wine stuff at the beginning and the 7 towers. And yet it's as easy as pie when you know the truth.
And do you, if I might ask?
Oh, I think you might, son. And the answer's yes, with a bit of luck. B Besides all the clues you've seen scattered around just as much as I have, would you mind calling up old Draymond again?
Draymond?
Grimo's chum from the old days, would you, Hadley?
Oh, I suppose I might as well if it'll help.
Betts.
Yes, sir?
Stop fidgeting about, Ted. Sit down again.
Okay, Superintendent?
He'll be up in a minute. All right, Phil. What's it all about, eh?
Hocus, as I dare say you'd call it. Guesswork and inspiration and all those blame cues, clues staring us in the face. All the real magic, in short. Now wait till I get up on my feet. This needs it, my sons.
Can I give you a hand, Doctor?
Thank you. Well, now, gents, it goes like this, you see. Three graves in a country that don't exist at all, as young Ted was bright enough to spot, and that jade buffalo on the desk over there and that coat of arms over the fireplace. And one or two books in those shelves that I've been having a look at.
What books?
Look at this lot, for example. Listen here. See, Ted?
Shakespeare, Minden, Munkai. Well, what does that mean when it's at home? Except that Shakespeare's obviously in it somewhere.
It means the old maestro's complete work, son, translated into Hungarian. Oh. And on the flyleaf of Volume 1, there's a name, and that's Hungarian, too.
Ernestine Dumont.
No, my lad. Charlie Grimo's his real name. Caroy or Charles Grimo Horvath.
Horvath? Wait a minute.
You got it, Hadley. Hover, bath, bath, you see. When you hear things only imperfectly, you tend to fit the sounds of the things you know. Horvath isn't exactly a usual word, although it's a common Hungarian name. So young Ted here didn't quite get it in one go. Our dying friend was trying to tell us who he really was and maybe who his murderer was as well.
How do you mean?
I mean that Grimo, too, came originally from Transylvania, which used to be a part of Hungary. But then was annexed after the Great War by Romania. In other words, a country that doesn't exist.
That picture. But I didn't mean it that way, Doc.
Never mind. You hit the truth, son. That coat of arms up there represents the old Transylvanian crest. You can look it up if you like. And as for buffaloes, Transylvania was the only European country where they bred them to use like oxen.
But damn it, Phil, how do you know all this about the wretched place if it doesn't exist anymore?
Because I went there for a holiday in my younger and lither days, just after I'd first read Dracula, which you made fun of earlier tonight. That's how I know the rest as well.
Don't tell me they used to put salt in their wine.
No. But they did have salt, son, mountains of it. Digging it out was one of their major industries.
Mine. Wine, mine. He said salt mine.
So he did, Ted. Salt mine. And I'll tell you this. They used to use convicts in Transylvania to work those salt mines, same as they do now in Siberia, often dangerous ones. Big prison camps they had in the mountains. And the worst of those camps was called the...
Excuse me, Superintendent. Mr. Draymond.
Oh, thanks, Betts. Come in, Mr. Draymond.
I understand you want me again, Superintendent.
I'm sorry, Mr. Draymond. Dr. Phil has a few more questions, it seems.
Won't take a moment, sir. Will you sit down?
Thank you.
I didn't disturb you, I hope.
I was about to retire. I was playing with my toys for a few last moments to take my mind from this dreadful thing that has befallen poor Greenmore.
Your toys, Mr. Draymond?
Oh, yes, Superintendent. I fear that I am looked on as something of an eccentric, perhaps, but, well, it gives me much pleasure to entertain the little ones.
You mean children's toys, sir?
Certainly, young man. I make them, you know, as a hobby. I'm very fond of children. I lost my own in a dreadful accident many years ago. And my dear wife. It relieves my thoughts to try to amuse the youngsters in our neighboring streets here. Simple little devices for their festivals, like Christmas or the 5th of November and the like. I have quite a little store of such trophies in my room.
Most commendable, sir. Worthy cause, eh? If you'll forgive me, I'd like to talk about something else for a moment.
If it is anything that will help my poor old friend, I am at your service, Doctor.
Thank you. Now, you've known Professor Grimo for a long time, eh?
Oh, since I was a young man. But more closely since that terrible accident to my family that I mentioned. I fear it disturbed me a great deal mentally. I was unable to work. Grimo took me in and most kindly looked after me for old time's sake.
Because you saved his life once, eh?
Perhaps, sir.
I want you to listen to a story, Mr. Draymond. Maybe I ain't got all the details of it, and that's what I want you to fill in. Believe me, you'll be helping Caroy Grimo a great deal if you do.
Caroy, Doctor?
Just so, sir. Caroy Horvath, to be precise. And one of three brothers who were at one time in the early years of this century incarcerated in the notorious Transylvanian salt mine prison camp known as the Seven Towers.
Mr. Hadley, I don't know what your friend is talking about.
Oh, yes, you do, sir. And you'd be wise to admit it for your friend's sake, because I submit that he was a convict in that damnable hell on earth, buried alive, you might say. And he somehow escaped, and it's my guess that you helped him. Hey, sir?
Very well, Doctor. If you assure me that it will truly help Charles Grimaud, I shall speak at last. I don't know how you have found out all this.
Never you mind, sir. Just you tell us the story. Ted, there's some brandy.
Sure.
When you said buried alive, Dr. Fell, you spoke more truly than you knew. I fear that this is a very strange story. Quite fantastic and almost unbelievable, but it did happen. And perhaps it only could have happened in that old Hungary I used to know. Ah, thank you, young man.
There were three brothers, hey?
Let me come to it in my own way, Doctor.
Very well.
In those days, very early in the century, gentlemen, I had to do much traveling on the continent, especially in Transylvania, as it was then called. Most of the roads were mere mountain tracks, and I had to go much on horseback. But I rather fancied the romantic figure that I must have cut as a cavalier in those picturesque territories.
Not so picturesque near those damn salt mines, Mr. Draymond.
No, perhaps not, sir. And indeed, I was very near the salt hills on this particular day. I was in a great hurry to reach the town of Trag, for there were rumors of the bubonic plague in the Seven Towers district. Suddenly, gentlemen, at dusk, I came on a small, gloomy clearing in a wood, and in it there were three new gravestones.
The picture. That picture.
Yes, young man. The very scene itself. Charles once described it to his friend Burnaby, the artist who painted it, although Burnaby never realized its personal significance, of course.
What do you mean by personal significance?
You can perhaps judge of my horror all those years ago, Mr. Hadley, when, as I approached those three lonely graves, I suddenly saw that on one of them, the earth was upheaving and sliding, and there was a cracking noise, and something began to twist and wriggle. And out of the earth there came a groping human hand with writhing fingers.
My God.
In another moment, gentlemen, a whole human personage came into view. And I was even more horrified to see that the face was swollen and disfigured, and covered with a scaly, pinkish spot.
Plague marks.
No, Doctor. Although I at first thought so myself, of course. I told you that this adventure of mine was fantastic, but the truth behind it is even more so. That figure from the grave became my best friend. He threw himself on my mercy that day, and in my romantic youth, I agreed to help him. And so I did. I got him out of the country and to Paris, where he changed his name from Caroy Horvath to Charles Grimaud. I managed that escape with the help of a devoted Hungarian girl he had once known who came with us and looked after him in the long illness that ensued.
Madame Dumont?
I did not say so, young man. Superintendent, you will perhaps be good enough to respect these old confidences of mine.
What the devil had happened, Draymond? What's all this talk of plague spots that weren't?
There were indeed three brothers named Horvath, Mr. Hadley. They were prisoners in the terrible camp of the Seven Towers. Two of them died of the plague, and the third, Charles, saw a wild, impossible chance of freedom. With the help of the prison doctor, who was a fellow convict and sympathetic, he marked his face with pigment and feigned to have died, too. He knew that in their terror from the infection, the warders would simply bundle the corpses into crude coffins and bury them hastily and shallowly. He was a very strong young man, and he had managed to conceal a pair of wire nail cutters in his clothes. All the same, he often said that the experience was hideous. When he heard the earth fall on his coffin lid.
Oh, say, by glory, he had a nerve.
At any rate, he achieved it, young man. He managed to force up the lid sufficiently to jam the nail cutters in the crack, and by sheer desperate force, he broke through at the very moment of my chance approach.
In heaven's name, what crime was it that these fellows were in for?
That was what finally decided me to help poor Karai that day. A mere political offense. The brothers had been no more than hot-headed students involved in some harmless continental insurrection.
Were they, by George, by Bacchus, Draymond, were they?
What do you mean, Doctor? Charles always told me...
I don't care what he told you. You listen to what I'm telling you. You're a very simple man, Mr. Draymond, if you'll forgive me, and Charles Grimaud has looked after you very well. But was it only from kindness, do you think?
My dear Dr. Fell, I...
Suppose your kind Karoy Horvath was in reality a monster. Suppose he looked after you so well to keep you from making too many inquiries about that prison of the Seven Towers and finding out that it was never used for political offenders at all, but only for the worst kind of criminals, murderers and dangerous thieves.
This is intolerable, Dr. Fell. I won't believe it.
No, you're too good. You're too good to comprehend that when you walked away with Karoy Grimaud from those three graves that day, you left two other living men behind.
It can't be true. It is true.
Oh, yes, it can be true, all right. Hadley, if you wire to the police at Bucharest, you'll be able to find out what it really was the brothers Horvath did. And I'll wager it was robbery on a big scale, probably with violence. And I'll submit further that all three of them were in that desperate escape plan. All three pretended death from the plague. Charles was the strongest. He had the implement to get out of his grave first. Thereafter, he was to help the other two. But he didn't, gents. Nightmare, nightmare, Hadley. Walked off and left them to rot alive and kept the loot from their old robbery for himself.
Do you know this for certain, Phil?
I'll swear to it with every shred of instinct in me. And you'll get confirmation from Bucharest. And it's worse, my lads. Karoy's millionth escape chance came off once. Maybe it could come off again. Maybe he wasn't the only Horvath to escape.
Wait a minute, Doc. You don't mean...
Yes, I do, son. Young Mangan said that there was something familiar about that visitor to the Warwick Tavern last Wednesday. And so there was. It was Grimaud himself that he reminded them of. Because Pierre Flay, masquerading as a harmless illusionist, was or is none other than...
Excuse me, Superintendent. A note from the nursing home.
Eh? Oh, thank you, Bits. Is he,
Professor Grimaud is dead, sir, just a few minutes ago.
Oh.
Did he say anything else before he did die?
I believe it's in the doctor's notes, sir.
For heaven's sake, read it, Hadley.
Just before the end, Professor Grimaud regained consciousness for a few seconds. He said quite clearly and distinctly, "It was my brother who did it. I never thought he would shoot. God knows how he got out of that room. One second he was there, and the next he wasn't. It was my brother."
Is that all?
That's all. Then he died.
You were right, Doctor. The hollow man. He was Pierre Flay, after all. Out for revenge. Grimaud's brother.
Was he, son? You won't forget, will you, that there was still another brother. And he might be anyone. Anyone in this house or in that damned club at the Warwick Tavern. Oh, yes, gents. The hollow man might be anyone.
It wasn't until the next morning, back in Adelphi Terrace, that we learned from the newspapers how right Gideon Fell had been. Murder by magic was what the headline said. And the reports went on to describe how a man had been killed in the middle of Cagliostro Street, WC1, apparently at the very moment when we were investigating the Grimaud murder around the corner. And this second victim was...
Flay. Pierre Flay himself, confounded. Dead as a doornail, too.
Yeah, so Ted and I have just been reading. Sit down and have some breakfast, my boy.
No, thanks. I've had some. I've been up all night on the blasted thing, Phil.
When did you hear about it?
Just after you and young Rampole here left Russell Square.
And you didn't tell the old man?
Maybe I'd had enough of you.
You and your hocus. All right, all right. I'll take that back. Fact is, I got too tied up with routine work for one thing. I thought that at least one of us had better have a good night's rest. This new nonsense is even more impossible than the Grimaud job itself.
You better have some coffee at least. And let's hear all about it. Got a cup, Ted?
Sure.
Honestly, Phil, I'm losing my mind over this whole damnable thing. A locked room case is bad enough. But this is a locked room turned inside out. It's an open street case.
Let's have it, I said, from the beginning. Forget we've read the papers.
Sugar, Superintendent?
Thanks, Rampole, too. Right, then. Last night, just after 10 o'clock, two men were walking along Cagliostro Street, a couple of harmless visitors to London from Birmingham. We've checked on them. They were on their way to visit a friend who lives at the end of Cagliostro.
Now, wait a minute. If I remember, it's a cul-de-sac, ain't it?
About 200 yards long, leads off Guildford Street, one of those little out-of-the-way London alleyways, as you said last night. There's a high blank wall right across the far end, and one or two shops on either side, and the rest are ordinary flat-roofed terrace houses.
Right. So there are your two harmless Birmingham men walking along it.
They were on the right-hand pavement, and one of them, a Mr. Blackwin, was turning round to check on the door numbers when he noticed a man walking along behind them.
Pierre Flay?
Nobody knew that till later. Anyway.
Hang on, son. Why did this Blackwin particularly notice this chap walking along behind?
Two reasons, he said. First, because he was walking right in the middle of the road and not on the pavement at all. And second, because he seemed a bit nervous and doddery.
Doddery?
Well, that's what Blackwin said. Anyway, they weren't the only witnesses. It so happened that one of our chaps, a constable on the beat, he was just crossing the entrance end of the street, and he noticed this figure walking in the middle of the road, too.
How did everybody see so deuced well?
Because, Phil, there was a lighted jeweler's shop window about a third of the way along, and Flay was just passing it. I wish you'd let me tell it my own way.
Carry on, son.
Well, the two Birmingham men went on, and suddenly, in that empty street, they heard a voice distinctly say...
Another cup, Mr. Hadley?
It's a... Oh, confound you, Rampole, no. Why the deuce don't you listen?
Sorry.
Oh. All right, son. You're doing your best, I know. So it said, Hadley, this mysterious voice...
It said, the second bullet is for you. And it laughed. And there was the sound of a shot, and when Blackwin and his friend whirled round, the man behind them screamed and staggered and then fell.
And the constable confirms this?
As soon as he heard the shot, he ran into Cagliostro Street himself, and he was in time to see Flay collapse.
Dad?
Not quite. Withers, that's the constable, got the two Birmingham chaps to carry him along to a doctor who's got a place right at the far end. And then he looked around for footprints.
Snow, eh?
Yes. That damnable snow. Been the curse right through the whole business.
Maybe you're right, my boy, and he didn't find any footprints according to the newspapers.
Not one. There were Flay's marks right along the middle of the road, all alone, and not another single trace. The only thing that Withers did find was the gun, about 10 feet behind where Flay had fallen. It was a heavy pattern .38 revolver with two empty cartridges in it, the same kind of gun that killed Grimaud. With not a single fingerprint on it.
It was the same gun itself, and never mind, just the same kind.
But wait a minute, Superintendent. It's easy, surely. It could have been thrown down from one of the flat roofs. Flay could have been shot from there.
Could he, Rampole? Then just you listen. Because this time, when they examined Flay at the doctor's, there were powder marks round the wound. Whoever shot him stood right against him in that damned empty street. And you can rule out suicide again because the wound was in his back. And the doctor's report says that no mortal man could have reached round far enough. I tell you, Phil, that I almost am beginning to believe in magic. I've got visions of damnable, faceless things that can fly.
Now steady, steady, son. You just haven't had enough sleep. That's what's wrong with you. I gather Flay died without coming round.
Within half an hour. And he wasn't identified until about 2 o'clock.
Well, how was that, Superintendent?
You'll remember that I sent off one of my men to look for Flay last night,
yeah.
Young Sergeant Summers. He went down to the Academy Music Hall place and found he'd gone, walked off earlier in the evening just before he was due to go on for his act.
Ha! Phil, if you say ha once more in this case,
Sorry, son. So then what?
Well, young Summers got round to Flay's lodgings, number 2B in Cagliostro Street, you remember.
Uh-huh.
Top room above a little stationer right at the entrance end.
Yes, and what's more, a deaf stationer.
Eh? How the deuce did you know?
Oh, never mind, my boy. What about young Summers?
Well, he got to Cagliostro Street about an hour after Flay's death. He'd a shrewd suspicion who the corpse was, and he went to dig up somebody to confirm it.
Who, sir?
Some wild Irishman who worked on the same bill at the theatre.
Summers had been talking to him earlier. He's an acrobat, name of O'Rourke, except that for some blasted reason he calls himself the Great Pagliacci.
Better and better. Real chaps now on flying trapezes, eh? Right, my sons. You'll let me get out of my dressing gown and we'll nose along the Magic Street. Give us something to do at least. I never did know how to pass the time on a Sunday morning.
Well, there it is, Phil. There's the layout. Cagliostro Street.
Oh, deuced cold street, too, even if there is a thaw.
There's still enough snow left to see Flay's tracks over there.
Yeah.
Of course, the place is a bit messed up from our chaps and the Birmingham men when they picked up the body, but we've kept the rest as clear as we could.
Uh-huh. And this is the doctor's house just behind us, eh?
Flay's still in there, in fact. Didn't want to move him till we got everything cleared up. If we ever do...
Quite right, son, and we will. Let's go over to the jewelers. By the way, Hadley, did you wire to Bucharest about that old business of the Horvath brothers?
Hours ago. Last night, in fact.
Good.
Should have word back today sometime.
Looks as if you were right, Doc. Now that Flay's dead, too, it only could have been the third brother. All three must have escaped after all that day.
I wonder who he is. O'Rourke.
Hey? Now, look here, Hadley.
In heaven's name, Phil. I didn't mean that.
Huh?
I meant over there, just coming in from Guildford Street with young Summers. The Irish acrobat from the music hall. I told Summers to bring him along again for more questions.
I see, and yet maybe...
Wait a minute, sir. I just thought of something.
Oh, what now, in heaven's name?
This empty house just here. Did you notice it, Doc?
Now, listen, young Rampole. It was just about the first thing that we did notice.
Yeah,
and we've been over it with one of those blasted fine-tooth combs that people in books keep talking about.
But, Mr. Hadley, I mean, suppose the hollow man got into it last night, and if he had a long pole, maybe, and suppose he had the gun rigged up at the end of it somehow, and a long string.
Son, to begin with, let's get into this shop opening. I'm juicy chilly. Ooh, and let me tell you something. I said last night, when you muttered something about a secret panel, this is a real murder story we're in. You never mind about long blazing poles and deadly poisons that nobody's ever heard about, and bodies inside grandfather clocks and such. You have Hadley right off his nut, you.
I'm sorry. It was just an idea. But I'll tell you one thing that might be real. About old Mr. Drayman last night and those toys of his.
Yeah, 5th of November. Hey, all right, son. We'll keep it in mind. By the way, though, Hadley, talking of clocks, this old one in the jeweler's window, I suppose that's how everybody was so darn sure of the time last night.
Well, as a matter of fact, it was. Withers made a note as soon as he got on the scene.
I wonder about that. Just after 11 now, eh? So it was just over 12 hours ago when poor old Flay got it. And there were we around the corner in Russell Square, and by backers, if I'd only followed out that blazing hunch of mine a bit sooner.
Morning, Superintendent.
Ah, morning, yeah, Summers. Morning. Brought O'Rourke, I see.
Yeah, got your message round to Bloomsbury Street Station. Mr. O'Rourke's been making a general statement there.
Good, good. I'm sorry to trouble you again, O'Rourke. One or two more questions?
Ah, not at all. And the top of the morning to you, Mr. Superintendent, as we're supposed to say in Ireland.
This is my colleague, Dr. Fell, and a friend, Mr. Rample.
Pleased to meet you, gents. Sure. Haven't I heard of you before, Dr. Fell?
If it's that deuced old nursery rhyme.
You'll be meaning, I do not like thee, Dr. Fell.
Different fellow altogether, you'll understand.
I wonder. Well, now, O'Rourke, I want to go over some of our last night's ground again. And what you told us when you'd identified Pierre Flay over there.
Anything at all, Mr. Hadley. Say the word.
Will you repeat to Dr. Fell exactly what happened at the Academy Theatre yesterday evening?
Surely I will. The reason why I cannot tell, but this is just what did befell. Hola!
Thank you, son. Most entertaining. Ted? You remind me to go and see Mr. O'Rourke's side-splitting act one day.
Oh, no. Don't get me wrong, Doc. No offense. Besides, I'm no gag man. I never open my mouth on the boards. The old trapeze. And I'm the Great Pagliacci, do you see? Of course, they don't want any Irishman with a shillelagh on the high wire. But by the time I've on me fine Italian whiskers, Doctor...
The faces of all good illusion, Mr. O'Rourke. What the eye wants to see, it does see. Will you continue? About poor old Looney Flay, as I'm told you call him?
Ah, so he was, too. Played the same bill with him many a time and never could make him out.
Kept pretty much to himself, eh?
Hardly spoke to a soul, except when he had to. And even then, it was mostly about coffins and being buried alive and such.
So we've heard. And last night?
Well, Doc, there I was, you see, just off from my own act. And I thought I'd sneak down to the old theater boiler room for a smoke. We're not allowed to backstage, you see. And there was old Looney Flay, right in front of the old furnace with a hatchet in his hand, knocking the bejabers out of his conjuring props and stuffing them in the fire.
But what for?
Well, that's what I asked him. because I knew it was on in another 5 minutes, you see. And to see in that queer way of his, I am destroying me equipment, Signor Pagliacci. My work is finished. I shall no longer need it.
Anything else?
Well, naturally, I tried to stop him. I thought he'd gone right off his rocker at last, but he burnt the lot all right. And then off he goes. And he turns at the door and he says, as pleasant as a three-card man, he says, goodbye, Signor. I am returning to me grave. And that was the last of him.
You never saw him again?
No, not until he was stretched out over the street there. That was poor Looney, all right. And he got what he wanted, gents.
Yeah, so it appears. Now tell me, Mr. Rook, these props of his, as you call them, what do they consist of, eh?
Oh, a few collapsible cabinets with false sides and so on, and a couple of so special ropes.
Ropes?
Ah, you know the kind of thing, Doc. Got a kind of suction cup at one end, so as when you throw them up in the air, they'll stick to the rope. Kind of Indian rope trick effect.
Wait a minute. Doctor.
Steady, son. Hang on. Anything else, Mr. O'Rourke?
No, I reckon that was about the last. Oh, Looney was good, you know. I never did know how he managed half his vanishing tricks. Even if I did, I wouldn't want to tell much. You know, the trouble is, most folk are so damn disappointed when they know how a trick's done. It's a funny thing, but so they are. It's almost as if they really did expect magic. Well, maybe it's because the explanation is always so simple, do you see? They made me feel they'd been diddled somehow. Like the old disappearing horseman job, for instance.
Yes, thank you, O'Rourke. Maybe it's beside the point a bit.
Yeah, maybe it ain't. I told you last night that nothing was beside the point, Hadley. What disappearing horseman, son?
Well, it's one of the most famous illusions of the lost. And you can work it in an open field. Ooh, no trapdoors, no wires, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You see, out rides the old illusionist, all in a grand blue uniform and on a big white horse.
Mm-hmm.
And out come all his attendants, all in white uniforms. Bands playing, the works, you know. Well, then, two of the attendants whisk up a big fan. And just for a minute, you see, it hides the chap on the horse. Okay. And when it comes down again, the old saddle's empty, man vanished.
Well, how's it done, then?
Simple. That grand blue uniform of his is made of paper over a real white one. Plain crepe paper. And as soon as the fan goes up, he tears it off and stuffs it in his pocket. Then he jumps down off the horse and mixes in with the attendants, do you see? And there you are. Of course, nobody's ever bothered to count that lot. So, hey presto, bang, greatest show on earth.
Well, I...
And now, don't you say it, my boy. Don't forget it's Sunday. You hear them bells?
Wow!
Hey, glory be. What's wrong with the doc, Mr. Hatton?
I said, wow, O'Rourke, wow, and by Beckett's head again, wow!
Fell in heaven's name,
man. I've got it, Hadley, I've got it. The bells.
Bells?
Church bells, did you hear them? Light, Hadley, light at last in all me heathendom, and glorious messages in the belfry.
You don't mean bats?
I mean the truth and nothing but the truth, and as soon as you get the answer to your cable from Hungary, I'll tell you it too, every mortal nightmare fragment of it.
The Hollow Man, you know who he is?
The Hollow Man never existed, son. That's what those bells are telling me. He never existed.
This is idiocy, Phil. Are you trying to tell me that Grimaud wasn't murdered after all?
Grimaud was murdered.
And Flay?
Pierre Flay was murdered.
Then who the devil did it?
Someone who has spoken to us and even told us that he'd done it.
Stuart Mills, that secretary. His evidence was false.
His evidence was true and exact to the last dotted I, and I mean I, E-Y-E.
Then it was Brayman, the old Scotsman. It must have been.
What about me and Glory's name? Don't I get any limelight? Trapeze and all.
Be quiet, O'Rourke. And yet... Oh, no, it's absurd. Phil, who is this damnable third brother?
A man long dead and rarely in his grave. Don't you see, Hadley, even now? The evidence is before your eyes, this very minute, in Cagliostro Street. Look, man, and listen. Ring out, wild bells! Ring out!
That was that. As far as Gideon Fell was concerned, that moment long ago when the bells rang out in Cagliostro Street was the true end of the case of the Hollow Man. For the rest of the day, until Hadley's cablegram arrived from Bucharest, he shut up like a clam, and even a gloomy clam at that. And then, at last, the cablegram did come, and we went round to Russell Square to meet the superintendent again and the murderer. Can I confess, towards the end here, that when it was all over and I knew what had really happened, there was just a trace of that, that disappointment that our queer friend O'Rourke had mentioned. I don't know what I expected that winter's evening when I tried to piece all the fragments together. Maybe real magic after all. Maybe you'll feel a little bit that you've been tricked, too. And yet you haven't been, believe me. You've got all the evidence fairly and squarely, as much as any of us had. It's just inevitable, I suppose, in every locked room case. And don't forget that here, in a way, there were two. Anyway, we reached the house and climbed up to Grimaud's fatal study. And there he even lay before us in his open coffin, brought round from the nursing home. The last silent witness to the truth himself. And beside him, dressed in black, looking down with a face of unutterable grief.
Madame Dumont?
Why did you come here again, Dr. Fell? Why do you look at me with a face like that?
Because, madame, I believe it will do you good to confess.
Fell, what are you saying, man?
Wait, Hadley. Well, madame...
To confess, sir? I? To murder?
No, ma'am, because you are not the murderer. You were only the confederate of a great illusionist.
If you mean Pierre Flay...
I do not mean Pierre Flay. You know who I mean. Believe me, Madame Dumont, if I could have explained this whole thing without bringing you into it at all, I'd do so with all my heart. I know how you've suffered. The man you loved lies dead before you. Our only problem, yours and mine, is to hush things up so the living may not be hurt. Among others, your innocent daughter by that man.
What?
Will you not help me to persuade Superintendent Hadley to do that? As I'm certain I can.
Do you know the truth, then? Do you really know?
Yes, I really know.
Oh. Very well. Will you give me a moment in my room? Perhaps I cannot face you now. Before him. I must think. But then I will tell you.
Madame...
Please, Superintendent, be assured. I will not run away.
Leave her, Helen. You are a servant, madame.
What the devil does this mean, Fell? What monkey business are you up to now?
It's all right, old friend, believe me. She'll confirm everything I'm going to tell you later. Besides, it may be just as well. Maybe it's right as the final irony for us to be alone with the murderer. All three of us.
Dr. Fell.
Oh, yes, my son, he's here in this room. There, Hadley, in that coffin, Professor Charles Grimaud.
Fell, you're joking. Are you trying to tell me that Grimaud killed Flay?
Yes, son, I am.
While he was lying at death's door in a nursing home, before witnesses, reputable doctors, that he got up and went into Cagliostro Street?
Before that, my boy, and before Flay killed him.
You're mad.
Maybe I am sometimes. Sit down, Hadley. You too, Ted. We'll take it in order, hey?
Professor, to be as well, Doc. You don't mean...
Now, wait, son. Hadley, you got that cablegram from Bucharest?
I told you on the phone what it said.
Yeah, never mind. Read it out for Ted's sake.
Oh, all right, if I must. It says, for robbery of Kunar Bank, November 1898, three brothers Horvat, sentenced to 20 years penal servitude in Salt Mines, prison of the Seven Towers. All three, with aid of prison doctor, during plague scare of 1901, made daring attempt at escape by being certified as dead. Two warders, passing graves an hour later, saw disturbance had taken place at grave of Karoy Horvat, coffin open and empty. Digging in two other graves, found Pierre Horvat, insensible but still alive. Nicholas Horvat had already suffocated to death. Pierre returned to prison, scandal hushed up. No chase of fugitive. Pierre Flay Horvat, released after full term. Never mentally responsible after terrible experience. Last heard of as theatrical performer, illusionist for which he had early talent. Proceeds of robbery never recovered, believed hidden. Signed, Tsuzar, Police Director, Bucharest. There.
But, Doc,
It doesn't make sense, surely. If the third brother was dead...
I told you he was in Cagliostro Street this morning. I suddenly realized he had to be, and all I needed was confirmation.
But at the Warwick Tavern, Flay distinctly said...
Flay distinctly said exactly what he wanted to say. He wasn't as crazy as he liked to pretend. Since ever he'd been released, he'd been trying to trace that Judas brother of his. And at last he had, in Caroy's new identity of Professor Grimaud. And when he confronted him, he took care to do it before witnesses.
Why?
Because after all his sufferings, he wanted a share of that hidden loot that had given Grimaud so much comfort through the years. And so every word he uttered last Wednesday was a hint at blackmail. Knowing that Grimaud would recognize him, and what a ghastly moment it must have been for the old boy, Flay then used his dead brother as a threat. He knew that Grimaud could still be deported and hanged for murdering him. That was why he used such double-edged phrases as, my brother is much more dangerous to you than I am. Would you rather he visited you? And so on. And then he gave Grimaud his address so the rich man could call on him and make a settlement. And he felt sure he'd be safe, because if he was killed, everybody in that pub would connect Grimaud with his death.
And yet Grimaud did kill him, you say?
He had to. Or his own easy life was over. And so he planned to do it, but in such a way that he would never be found out. And by Bacchus, he almost succeeded.
Oh, well, tell us.
Grimaud was a real expert on magic, and he determined on a grand illusion with the help of a single confederate.
Dumont?
Yes, yes, his old boyhood sweetheart, who'd served him faithfully through all her life. Now, this was the effect he intended to create. A man was to be seen calling on him. This man was to be rather crudely disguised, as Flay might have disguised himself, having threatened Grimaud before witnesses. Anyway, having arrived at the house, the man goes into Grimaud's study here. A shot is heard. The door being burst open, Grimaud is found alone with a nasty-looking but superficial wound along his side. Out of the window hangs a rope, one of Flay's conjuring ropes, by means of which Flay is assumed to have escaped. Great-hearted, Grimaud says weakly, he thought he killed me and I pretended to fall dead, but I'm hardly hurt. Don't set the police on him, poor crazy devil, whoever he is. And then, next morning, Looney Flay is to be found dead in his lodgings, having shot himself through the heart. A remorseful suicide with the gun in his hand. Grimaud recovers and lives happily ever afterwards. Et voila!
But how did he propose to do all that?
Ah, by means of that famous picture over there, which he even said he'd bought to defend himself. However, I'll come back to that. The point is that everything went wrong with the golden plan.
Obviously.
Grimaud had written to his brother Flay to say that on reflection he would meet his blackmail demands. And he'd call on him in his lodgings about 9:30 on Saturday night to make a settlement. Flay gleefully gives up his job at the theatre and burns his properties, telling O'Rourke, quite truthfully, that he was going back to his grave, although he only meant that he was never going to reveal his true identity. Then he hurries to his room in Cagliostro Street.
Above the deaf stationers?
Yes, I guessed he must be deaf, by the way, or he'd have heard something of what happened. Grimaud must have checked on that, too. He, meantime, Grimaud, I mean, had left his house in Russell Square carrying a heavy revolver loaded with 2 bullets.
Why did nobody see him?
A, he quite simply left by the basement. B, he had instructed Mills' secretary to take up his position across the hall out there at 9:30. Now, just at that time, Madame Dumont was to be seen coming from the study with Grimaud's empty coffee tray, giving the impression that he was still inside. Right then, to continue. Grimaud reaches Cagliostro Street. He doesn't risk being seen going into Flay's lodgings. Instead...
That empty house...
You got it, son? He goes in there by the back way, up to the top, and approaches his brother's room, also at the top, you'll remember, across those flat roofs we all noticed. He enters, and Flay is waiting for him. He makes a fine, soft speech. I'm sorry, my brother. I have acted abominably. Of course, you shall have a share of our old loot. And then he whips out his gun and lets Flay have it. Phew. Now, this is where things went wrong. What Grimaud meant to do next was to turn the gun on himself and wound himself superficially in the side. He was going to patch up that wound with some sticking plaster that he had ready and then press the gun into Flay's hand to make his death look like suicide. Then he was going to get back home, by way of the roof and the empty house again, to work his great illusion of Flay visiting him. In short, his perfect alibi.
Which you haven't told us about yet.
I said I was coming to it. We're still in Cagliostro Street. And what really happened there was, I think, that Flay was subconsciously on his guard. When Grimaud raised the revolver, Flay turned to run. And instead of shooting him in the heart, Grimaud shot him in the back, but still near enough to show powder burns. And then Grimaud panicked.
It's the only explanation. Maybe Flay had screamed out. Maybe Grimo thought he heard sounds of pursuit. At any rate, he lost his nerve. He threw down the gun, hoping that he could still somehow establish an alibi back at home and that Flay's death would be attributed to somebody unknown. He turned and ran. And he even forgot to take one of the ropes Flay kept in his lodgings that was to have been part of his plan. He told us so in his dying speech.
The only part of it we didn't explain before. I realized that this morning when O'Rourke mentioned ropes. Forgot about rope, Grimo said.
Well, go on. What next?
Grimo ran. And back in his room, Pierre Flay suddenly staggered to his feet.
What?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. He was fatally wounded, but not immediately fatally. He picked up the gun for evidence and stumbled downstairs and into the street. He had only one thought, to get to the doctor's, which was at the far end of Cagliostro Street, you remember, and he walked nervously in the middle of the road because he was afraid that his murderer might still be near at hand and see him. And that is precisely what happened, my sons. His murderer did see him.
How do you mean, in heaven's name?
Remember Grimo running across the roofs to the empty house? By this time, his panic was leaving him. Perhaps he had only imagined the sounds of pursuit to make sure he hesitated and opened the front door of the empty house to look out. And there, staggering towards him, was the man he had shot. It was what he meant in his last speech of war, you remember? God knows how he got out of that room. I.e. the room in Cagliostro Street. Not this room at all.
Well, I'm darned.
Flay saw Grimo at the selfsame moment. For the last time, those two doomed brothers confronted. It was Flay's own voice that your witnesses heard, Hadley, as he cried out, "The second bullet is for you!" He fired at Grimo. The fatal effort was too much. He threw the gun away behind him, and the snow washed it clean of fingerprints, and Flay fell down and lost consciousness, later to die. And that, my sons, is the answer to the murder by magic in Cagliostro Street.
And if you expect any applause from me, you won't get it. Not till you tell us what happened back here. The Hollow Man.
I'm coming to it right now, son. That bullet of Flay's got Grimo in the chest. He staggered back into the empty house and so wasn't seen by your witnesses, incidentally. At first, he thought he was done for. Then he realized that the wound maybe wasn't so bad after all. In fact, by a miracle, everything was actually playing into his hands. He was back where he meant to start. He could even pull it off yet. His grand illusion.
He must have had a nerve of iron.
He did, son. Don't forget that it was the same man who burst out of that grave 35 years ago.
Yeah.
So he got out with his plaster and he bound up that wound in his chest. Then out through the back way again and round to Russell Square.
Going in through the basement again. Hence no footsteps on the front steps.
Correct, my boy. Madame Dumont, his confederate, was waiting for him inside. He hastily explained what had happened and told her that they could still go on with their plan. And she helped him to dress.
To dress?
Yes, in the costume that they had already, including the child's false face from poor old Daddy Draymond's toy store. By the way, I'm certain that that was what he was going to say at the end of his speech last night. Don't blame poor Draymond. Lest any of us jump to the source of the false face.
So he was the mysterious visitor himself.
Yes, he'd arranged his witnesses in the hall. Lest for any reason they should interfere, he locked in young Mangan and his daughter Rosette. And then he opened the front door and rang the bell from inside and then followed Ernestine Dumont upstairs.
Her surprise was a fake.
Of course it was. Anyway, there was Mills in his position as witness, and inside this room, Grimo's main prop, as O'Rourke would say, was ready for the great illusion itself.
What prop?
Last night, Hadley, when I asked you to show Ted and me that colossal picture there, you swung it round with ease. And yet earlier, we'd heard from young Ted himself that it took two men to cart it up the stairs out there.
Well?
Because it wasn't the subject of the picture that mattered. That was almost a coincidence. It was its sheer size. Because, hidden behind the canvas and smuggled in that way into this house, there was an object just as large as the picture, and yet thin enough not to be noticed behind it, and an enormously heavy object, a mirror.
A mirror?
Yes,
A folding hinge at the back of it, so that it could be made to stand upright, just as Grimo did make it stand before he left for Cagliostro Street to murder Flay. Go and open that door, son. Pull it just wide enough for a man to come in through.
Like this?
Just like that. And imagine the mirror propped diagonally across the opening headlit, facing out. And remember that the room is black carpeted, and so is the hallway outside the room, and both paneled in dark oak.
Good life. Good life, Phil.
Stuart Mills, that very precise young man, told you exactly what he saw from his room over there. Hadley, he told him what he was meant to see. He saw the Dumont push open the door for the man in the false face. He saw what he thought was the interior of the study, but in actual fact it was part of the reflected hallway outside. He saw the visitor take off his cap, to which, although he didn't know it, the false face was attached. And instantly, in his very word, Professor Grimaud appeared on the threshold looking out. And he heard the professor's voice as he spoke to himself.
But, Phil...
Wait, I've almost finished. Mills saw Grimaud leap forward as if to intercept his visitor. In reality, that was the reflection of the real Grimaud as he walked into the room. And then he locked the door behind him and all was ready for the final master stroke.
But the mirror, Doctor, and the hollow man's overcoat and the mask, where were they when we broke in? And the sound of the shot?
It was the mirror that killed him, son. As to his clothes, his visiting clothes, our friend O'Rourke told us the answer to that without realizing it.
Wait a minute. All that burnt paper in the fireplace.
Yes, mask, cap, overcoat and all paper. Right, son. And something else of paper, too, that was burnt. Something that he filched from Draymond's November the 5th toy store at the same time as the false face.
A firecracker.
Just so. An ordinary Guy Fawkes penny banger. The sound of the shot. By Bacchus, he nearly did pull it off when you think of it. Maybe if he'd had time, he'd have flung the window wide open and marked the snow on the sill to make up for forgetting Flay's rope. But for all his cleverness, he'd forgotten something else, too.
What, sir?
His wound. He got the plaster off it and burned that as well. And that was his last mistake. It was worse than he thought, that wound. Madame Dumont realized that. That was why she was so agitated and shook the handle of the door. But in his arrogance, he cried out, you remember, go away, you fool, I can handle this. And so he signed his own death warrant.
You said the mirror had killed him.
You'll find it up in the chimney there, Hadley, inside that very wide flue I drew attention to last night. Propped up on the inner shelf where the chimney turns. But that mirror was enormously heavy. And he ripped his own lung, already torn by the bullet, like rotted rubber in the very effort of pushing it up there. It was the fatal hemorrhage. He staggered back to spill his blood on the couch there. And then to try to make for the door. So we found him. And to do him justice, he tried at the last of all to tell us the truth. Even to saying, not suicide, but meaning not his own death, but that he had killed Flay and that his death wasn't suicide.
And the church bells fell?
I knew before the bells how the illusion itself had been worked. But like you, like everybody, I still thought that Flay had been shot after Grimaud. And I couldn't see how. When we reached Cagliostro Street this morning, the old clock in that jeweler's window pointed just after 11, the clock that your policeman used last night to check the time of Flay's death. We stood talking to O'Rourke for quite some while. And then the church bells rang. And church bells always begin to ring well before 11. Sooner or later, somebody would have noticed it, of course, at Flay's inquest, probably. But it was enough to throw us out of reckoning in all the general excitement. That old clock was very fast, Hadley. Flay fell in Cagliostro Street long before 10 o'clock last night, not after it, as Withers naturally thought.
Well, and so it ends, then. So it ends, Doctor.
Aye, so it ends, son. And there's a lot in it that I don't like to think about. I don't even like to think about Grimaud in those last few moments when he must have realized that he'd failed after all.
After all the hates and the dodgings and the clever plans. And the blood was welling in his throat. And the world was going black. And there he lies now. In his second coffin. And at rest, eh?
Yes, Dr. Frank. At rest.
Madame. You heard them?
Almost all from the hallway there. When I came back from my room. More clearly when the door was opened. You are a very clever man, Dr. Fell.
Do you confess then, ma'am, that I am right?
In the best way I can. By joining him. It is all I ever wished.
What? You have a knife, madam. Oh,
too late, Mr. Hadley. Charles. Charles.
God forgive me, Hadley. God forgive me. I have committed another crime. I have guessed the truth again.
That was Norman Shelley as Dr. Gideon Fell, Barbara Cooper as Madame Ernestine Dumont, David March as Ted Rampole, and Lockwood West as Superintendent Hadley in The Hollow Man, a play by John Keir Cross from the early novel by John Dixon Carr. The rest of the cast was as follows. Boyd Mangan, David Spencer. Professor Grimaud, Anthony Vickers. Stuart Mills, John Scott.